I thought this morning of Ariadne's thread when I was anticipating speaking with you. I've lived a long life, and there is a thread that goes through all of my experiences. Maybe there are many threads, and following one with the theme of a way-seeking mind talk has been very instructive. I could follow another thread, my sexual experiences. I could follow the thread of my relationships. I could follow the thread of my lies. There are so many threads, but this one, it's good to have this direction, because I think it's a red thread. That's why I keep insisting on wearing bright colors to the Sangha instead of the black that I know I'm supposed to wear. I want to tell you first about an experience in Alaska, and it has very much to do with the precepts that we've been thinking about as we approach Jukai, the five of us. And that was fishing on the Stikine River with a fisherman whose way is a catch and release. This is out of Wrangell, Alaska. So we went fishing on the river, and we all caught fish, mostly salmon spawning, which is kind of unfair because the river is thick with them, and really they can't resist a fly, you know, but also trout. There were trout in the stream eating the eggs of the salmon. And the sensation of fighting a big, healthy king salmon, as I did one time, and bringing it into shore, and then letting it go, having it in my hands to take out the hook, which I was never able to do. I always had to have help with that. But holding the fish in my hands, and then when the hook was out, righting the fish so that it could swim out, feeling all that muscle and that life in the fish that I had just fought to bring to shore, letting it go and watching it swim away was a powerful experience. One of many great experiences, but I think the most relevant, because some of the theme of my red thread is death, fear of death, experience of death. When we were young, I grew up here, and my parents would take us to Muir Woods, and it was a time when there were no boardwalks, so you could freely run around and go down to the creek and get inside the trees and so on. And that was an early experience of total immersion in nature. And I think that all my life I tried to seek more immersive experiences from outside of myself, so that I welcomed those rare experiences where I was completely engulfed in sound and sight and smell and taste. And part of my journey has been to come to a place where I can live in the present without all of those sensations to distract and enclose me. Thanks to Jerry, I read a talk that Suzuki Roshi gave in 1970 when he spoke about way-seeking mind. He stated that way-seeking mind had to be awakened, or as he said, arisen. He said that it was difficulty in everyday life, particularly in one's young life, that provided the chance for the way-seeking mind to arise. And when it was arisen, quote, your practice is on track. I thought that was interesting. I had a way-seeking mind from childhood, and perhaps it arose through some difficulties as well as having a philosopher father. My little brother contracted polio at age 6, and I was 7 at the time, and he endured a couple of years of illness and recuperation. And I think there was a great deal of fear during that time on the part of my parents. I was not myself aware of the fear, at least I can't remember. And when I was 11, my parents came near to divorce, and there was again a 2 or 3 year period of fear about losing my father, which still evokes emotion in me. My role in the family was the good child. I was the only girl with 2 brothers and the one in the middle. And my mother's ally and helper is the role that I took. I became, I would say, addicted to praise and encouragement and approbation as a child and for a long time after. Have been hypersensitive to clues from others about how I am perceived. Both my parents came from the Midwest, my father from Wisconsin, the son of Russian Jewish immigrants who came to the States in 1890 from Russia. My mother was from long ago English stock, and she was born in Minnesota. She was Methodist, but both were secular and agnostic when they met, and they met at a seminar about Jesus as teacher. So both were interested in theology. Both were intellectually inclined. They moved to Mill Valley in 1937. My mother was a teacher, as I said, my father a philosopher, and he taught for many years at San Francisco State. One of my earliest memories is with my father is asking him big questions. What if the world would end? What if another planet would collide with us? And he would always answer me thoughtfully, as though I were an adult, a student, and reassuringly. Like, it will take 1,000,000 years for the planet to collide with us. My parents occasionally took me to an adult party. I don't know at what point. I think I must have been about 11, 10 or 11. And one time there was a kind of parlor game where people were being asked what their greatest fear was. And I was asked. I was the only child at the party. And I said my greatest fear was death. And the adult asking me seemed puzzled by this. He said, "Do you mean fear of the unknown?" And he couldn't get that a child would be afraid of death. How could a child have a concept of death? But after all, this was the 1940s, and we were surrounded by the shadows of the war and of the Holocaust and of starving children in Eastern Europe. And so I think it's not so remarkable that I was afraid of death. And I used to feel right before I went to sleep that there was a brooding and threatening presence that was coming toward me in my room, and it would go away, but then it might come back. And it was a waking, half-waking dream. My parents didn't divorce at that time. They stayed together for many more years. And my mother, who had toyed with communism for a number of years, joined the community church in Mill Valley. And my father was close friends with the minister, and that's the church that my brothers and I grew up in. And thank goodness for it, because it was a loving and supporting place to be. There were wonderful youth groups led by an extraordinary couple. Both of them have passed away now in recent years, but they shepherded us in through our adolescence. Especially lively discussions were part of it. And I think when I think about what I love about our Sangha, it is those lively discussions, and that has been something all my life that I've been interested in and wanted to participate in about issues. But there was also humanitarian activism in the community church. This one down here on Olive and Throckmorton. And I remember going to Christian Youth Fruit Camp when I was 15, near Modesto, and picking peaches to send overseas. And sometimes I wonder if my leaving Christianity was because there was a responsibility to be an activist. And I am not inclined to be an activist in a broad, huge way. I have small ways that I'm active in social justice, but they're very, very small. So in a sense, withdrawing from that might have been in part because it expected too much of me. I don't know, it's just an idea I had yesterday. And we know what those ideas are worth. Well, I was always something of a pantheist, too. And when I lost my Christian faith at 18 and no longer believed that Jesus was the Son of God or that there was such a thing as transubstantiation, I did retain my worship of nature. At 18, I was a counselor at our church camp, and I remember communion was coming up, a lovely place in the woods where we would have service and communion. And I told my minister friends there that I couldn't take communion because I no longer believed, could not make that leap of faith. And I remember their saying, oh, don't worry about it. Communion is just a gift. You can just take the gift. The gift is offered to you. You can take it. And I took communion that day and then didn't take communion again for many, many, many years. And I was always attracted to people of faith. And I was especially attracted to liberal Protestants and later one particular Catholic priest, who is still a dear friend, by their intelligence, their liberality, by their warmth, by their humility, and by their abiding faith, which they could question. And this kind of religious really drew me, whereas charismatic religious leaders didn't draw me at all. In fact, I shunned them pretty much. Gurus, you know, the kind of person that draws people by the force of their magnetic personality. And that kind of goes along with the fact that I'm not a big risk taker. I did almost no drugs at all, never any psychedelics. I have always taken very calculated risks. Always made sure I was with people who knew what they were doing and were sober. So maybe it's just, you know, safety or wanting control that kept me away from leaders like Werner Erhard, Richard Baker, you know, so on. So I finished college. I started college at College of the Pacific, did 2 years, quit to become an actress for a year. Working with a children's theater company in San Francisco. Acting had been one of my great pleasures as a youth. Worked as an actress and then went back to college at SF State and got my teaching credential. And back to activism, I went into the Peace Corps. Related to risk-taking, the Peace Corps in Colombia in 1964 seemed way safer than freedom rides in the South or marching in Selma. It absolutely did. I had no fear about going to South America at all. Now, that just was ignorance, perhaps, but it was also a peaceful period in Colombia, relatively speaking. I married at 24 my director in the Peace Corps, Bill Raymond. We had our first child when I was 25, and we lived overseas for the next 7 years in different countries, Honduras, Turkey, Nigeria. I loved the daily challenges of living in a foreign country, took to it very easily, learned language, studied culture, read literature. It was a very natural thing for me, and I liked being a mother. We had 2 sons, and our marriage was not a good, happy marriage. It was not. The best thing Bill and I did together was adjusting to new countries. And during the time that we were dependent on one another for that, because his work took him overseas, he worked for CARE, we got along. We were a good team. But we moved back to the United States, and that's when the marriage became stressed to the point of break. But in the meantime, back to my way-seeking mind, in Honduras, I joined a theology discussion group. This is where I met my Franciscan friend, Father Gratian. And I joined a local bilingual theater group and acted. And I met a wonderful woman originally from Austria who introduced me to the work of Krishnamurti. So I began to read Krishnamurti. But it was years before I understood that my happiness really depended on how creative I was being, what creative work I was doing. That was a long time coming. I did art, I played music, I did theater, but somehow it escaped me that that was really the center of my spiritual life. We moved to Connecticut. I went to NYU to get a graduate degree in educational theater. And then we moved to Washington, D.C. I acted the part of a philosopher, Simone Weil, in a play by Megan Terry. That was interesting. Again, that was probably all part of the red thread. And I began to write for newspapers, freelance journalism. My husband and I split in 1976, and during this time I was in psychotherapy, which I had been in and out of since I was 15. And very intensive work in trying to understand myself and change. I would say, very defensive about being right. I had to feel right, or I was terribly ashamed. I hated to disappoint people. I had a very hard time accepting flaws in myself. I would state the flaw so that nobody else could state it first. You know, I would acknowledge it, and yet it was all from a very self-protective place. In the divorce action, we went through a custody battle, which is a terrible thing to do. And I didn't have custody of my sons for 7 months until the major hearing at which I gained custody. Joint custody was very little known at that point. That was a very lonely period for me. I remember going to a party and not having to be home afterwards and feeling like I was lost, as though I was in space floating without a lifeline. I just remember that one evening. I did stay overnight on my host's couch, just feeling that there was nothing to anchor me to earth. My best friend during those years in Washington was a man who forced me to look at myself. He was remarkable in that I could say anything to him. I could strike out in words. I could cry and gnash my teeth, and it was all right. You know, it was over after that, and we were able to talk, and he could do the same with me, and that was a new kind of relationship for me, where I could be totally honest. And I'm eternally grateful for this friend, who now I'm completely out of touch with, having had a kind of a small altercation with his wife, at one point, and I miss him terribly, and he has Alzheimer's, and I don't know how he's doing. And that's been a terrible loss. But I had a hard time apologizing all my life, because apologizing meant acknowledging that I was in the wrong. And it's been a wonderful change that now I can apologize right away, as soon as I realize my mistake. And it doesn't, you know, it doesn't make me feel bad. You know, it makes me feel better to say. I wanted, from maybe my early 40s, I became aware that I wanted more than anything to achieve harmony. I wanted serenity. I didn't know how to get it, but I wanted it. And part of it came in times when I was able to be silent. On one of my birthdays, I went to a monastery in Maryland and maintained silence for a day and a night. And that was such a relief not to have to talk. You know, you think about little places along the journey where you are coming towards Zen, and certainly learning that I could be silent, that I loved silence, was part of that. I worked for the Smithsonian, I freelanced for DC papers, I tried the Unitarian Church, I joined a painting studio and painted seriously, I dated endlessly, and not very intelligently. I had a 6-month semi-serious relationship with a man. Men were not the answer. I joined the work based on the teachings of Gurdjieff. The work in Washington was very strong. It focused on becoming self-aware and dispelling delusion, our friend delusion, the waking sleep that Gurdjieff wrote we are all in, a lot of concentration on habitual actions and behaviors and kind of pushing yourself out of those. As Jacob Needleman wrote about the work, he was in the work, maybe still is, Gurdjieff's fundamental aim was to help human beings awaken to the meaning of our existence and to the efforts we must make to realize that meaning in the midst of life, to realize that meaning in the midst of life, being alive in the present, being aware of what's happening. I was getting closer to our practice, but it would still take years. I was a slow learner. In the work, we meditated or collected, it was called collection, and did exercises to become aware of our actions that we engaged in without thought, and so much more. And there was a lot of quietness in the work. People didn't have much affect when we were together. There were not a lot of smiles and charming kinds of actions, and I realized how much I was smiling all the time. I was smiling to ingratiate myself with people. And I was able to start to let my face relax. People in the work have an air of calm, some of them of detachment. And I don't know how deep the changes were in people, but for a while, for 2 years, I was in the work, and I practiced. We got to a point where we were doing the Gurdjieff movements, which are counter what we learn. If you've learned to always turn to the right in the Gurdjieff movements, you turn to the left. It's very interesting, and I liked them. But then some things happened, and I left the work. My older brother died in a drunk driving accident in 1979. My ex-husband committed suicide in 1981. And in 1982, my father died. So in that 3-year period, most of my energy went into surviving. And especially after their father died, I was concentrated completely that we would survive as a family. And eventually I decided to go home, to come home. So from Washington, when my oldest son graduated high school, went off to college, my youngest son and I came to Mill Valley. And that was a great decision. So that was in 1984, so I was 43 years old. I remember tears coming to my eyes when I saw the mountain. I was so happy to be home. And I remember living in a state of grace for about 3 weeks. And that was an unusual sensation at that time, but now I recognize what that is. It's when everything comes at the right time, when you know you are where you're meant to be. And I feel that more and more since being in the Sangha. You know, things seem to happen at just the right time, in small and large ways. An old friend, Concy Richardson, invited me to Green Gulch for a service with Richard Baker, whom she adored. She wanted me to experience this wonderful teacher. So here was my first experience with Zen. I went to Green Gulch for a service and a Dharma talk. And I was very unimpressed because he appeared to be very full of himself, and that turned me off. Concy also gave me Zen mind, beginner's mind, and I couldn't make head or tail. Completely opaque to me. Like the first time I read Jane Austen. I just couldn't get it, you know, until I heard it on audiobooks. But that was as close as I would come to Zen practice for another 25 years. It's funny though, I'd grown up going to Green Gulch Ranch because the Wheelwrights were close friends of my parents. And I was in the same class as Phil Richardson, Concy's brother, Hope Wheelwright's kids. And now it had come into my life again. The Zendo was where we used to play in the hay when we were kids. So I'd learned so much from my experiences overseas and on the East Coast, but being home grounded me and prepared me for the work I still had to do in finding and accepting myself and finding a path for my spiritual yearnings, really yearnings, deep. Here, things began to fall into place. I got my first long-term job at the Oakland Museum. I met my husband. I reconnected with my community. Some of my old friends were still here. I published books, you know. And I did three more things that seemed to be important. I think they've been important. One was back to therapy, right? Sand play, which is manipulating small objects in a tray of sand. A wonderful tool for artists because you make your universes, you make your worlds in that sand. And I did that for 7 years, about once a month. And then I started painting I painted the images of the trays then for 9 years after that, little by little. That's a great tool for understanding yourself because you see what symbols are important to you, and those I hadn't been aware of. So it was a very deep experience over those years. I'm very grateful for it. I also took a course at Esalen with George Leonard, who was a dear friend of some of the people here. And George and his sister, Julia Poppy, and his wife, Annie Leonard, our dear Annie, had developed a game called the Samurai Game, which was a virtual war game. And you played it, you know, with people in a closed setting. And I played the Samurai Game for a week at Esalen with George and other people. And it was amazing because it's set in ancient Japan, the code of Bushido. And I remember playing the sentry in the first game we did, and I had to stand still for 45 minutes. And so in the moment, everything was so immediate, I was able to be still for 45 minutes and then throw my orange juice can lid at an opponent and kill him. Very satisfying. And then, of course, this Sangha. Due to all the moves that I made, I had started and stopped many different disciplines and my way-seeking work. I had been distracted. I had, you know, taken some ancillary paths. But after this, even after this Sangha started at O'Hanlon, I stayed apart from it, and I don't know why. I had good friends in the Sangha. I liked Ed very much. I knew Lou. I was here all the time at O'Hanlon. I may have felt I didn't need it. I may have felt I didn't want to join a group because so much of my life I've kind of stayed apart. You know, never deeply involved with the same people over time. But then there was a series of things that happened that really led me here and definitively. In 2011, because of some family problems, actually long ago problems as well with alcohol, my older brother, the one who had died, caused the accident. I joined Al-Anon and started going to Al-Anon meetings and started working the 12 steps through Al-Anon. And it was absolutely right at the right time for me. And I had the most wonderful, still have the most wonderful sponsor. There's a great deal of similarity between Zen Buddhism and Al-Anon. And I think Al-Anon has gotten a lot from Zen. So many things overlap. And then a month after I started Al-Anon, I stopped drinking completely. And I had been, I would say, increasingly dependent on alcohol for 22 years. You know, it might only be two or three glasses of wine, but it was every day. And I didn't like what it did to me. And I felt it was part of the problem. You know, I was part of the problem.
Yeah.
So that has been a wonderful thing. It's now been over 3 years. And I'm happy. I'm happy. I knew about this meeting, as I said, but I think it was Annie's illness that brought me here. And her death. But I was able to be here a few times when Annie was here. And I loved those times. She was an extraordinary friend. She was very open. She was very loving and giving. So I feel now that all my questions and all my seeking has brought me here at the right time. And I am beginning to find that harmony, that serenity, that composure, as Celeste says, that I so desired. The two greatest things for me now are, well, gratitude, certainly, and humility, which I'm working at. I don't any longer agonize over disappointing people. I know I will and do, but I also know how to do, as they say in Al-Anon, a living amends, which means that I behave differently. All of the precepts, which I'm trying now to observe, I try not to lie. I'm pretty successful at not lying. I used to lie to save myself, protect myself, keep another person from being disappointed in me, even if the lie meant they were disappointed in themselves. Mm-hmm. That didn't seem to bother me, you know? Now I can't bear to think about that. I forget a meeting and the other person says, well, maybe it was my mistake, and I yes, probably it was. so mean-spirited. And so I feel all of my questions, all of my way-seeking has led me here, this dynamic place that will be changing, you know, that I want to become more deeply involved in rather than escape. I love the intellectual side of our Sangha. I love our discussions. I love the quiet side, the acceptance and the love in this group. So we suffer still, but Zazen gives us increased composure. And for the first time, perhaps in my life, for any extended period, I feel at ease with myself. I'm rarely afraid. I'm rarely defensive. Rarely is the operative. I'm always alert for learning. I'm not ashamed of my flaws like I used to be. And I want to thank you all for all the gifts that you give to me. Thank you. And if you have any comments or questions, I would love to hear them.
Just tears came to my eyes a number of times. It's so beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
Like, in, you know, you and I talked about the similarities, and when you talk about that silence that you found at different points in your life, and I can so relate to that. Because I think, you know, you're so engaging and can fill up the space, and yet you want this quiet. It's beautiful.
Thank you. Karen.
Thank you so much. I was changed by your talk in so many ways. And I think you brought harmony, and so I felt harmony. So what you were seeking, you seem to have found, and you're giving it as well, contributing. And I really thank you for the deep roots, connecting back up with Annie, and I'm seeing more and more that, so I do want to ask you about your coming around to death, your thread, your red thread. I'm seeing more and more that these people are with me who've died in a supportive way, and a tangible feeling of they're part of the bigger container. They're part of that holding. And Annie's death was really, really painful, and so unexpected. But to be able, I always felt in my life, I can't go through these things. Because my step-grandfather died when I was 7. And that was, we were just completely sheltered. But it was a huge event. And I felt like I don't know how to go through someone dying. So you're showing that in the deep roots of the people who have died in this Sangha that we're still connected with, and they're still part of the group, and we hold them. So thank you so much for that. And if you could come back around to what your feelings are about death at this point, I would love to hear it.
Well, I think I'm not as afraid of death, especially now as so many dear friends have died recently. You know, I still think I guess in more I worry about the moment, you know, the moment of being conscious that I'm dying and how I will deal with that, how I will. But I don't know if I'm answering your question. It's part of life, and it's going to happen to all of us. And I think we live, as Auntie Mame says, we live until we die. And that's what fascinates me now, is how alive people are, how alive and vibrant they are until they cross over. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Thank you. Abby, I am deeply moved by your honesty and your care in revealing yourself, because I find revealing myself very, very difficult. So I appreciate that very much. And please keep wearing bright colors. I think that's absolutely perfect.
Thank you, Elton.
Well, I'd like to say thank you. Just thank you.
Gail.
Thank you, Abby, for your talk. It's touched me in so many places. I mean, I could go on for hours and hours. A lot of similarities, the fears and things like that in the 40s, you know. And I'm a little bit older than you, so I, you know, that was a little closer in time for me. That was experiencing that. And just that whole thread. And also how I keep myself separate. I mean, which is something I deal with all the time that I don't like about myself, and sometimes feel not able to deal with it. And just listening to you has been very, very helpful for me.
Thank you, Gail.
Thank you.
Edward.
Well, I was very touched by all this. You being so present, you know, I mean, present. And one of the things that really struck me was that you were showing up at the right time for things to happen, as things happened to you. And I really had the feeling I was sitting here showing up like you are. And it was actually like a new sensation, actually. I mean, it was a different kind of identification, you know, showing up, being where you're being. Unbelievable. And that's what you evoked in me.
Thank you, Edward. Meredith.
You've been my teacher for many years, and I loved hearing your story. You've heard so many of mine. Thank you. Or read some, yeah. So thank you so much, Abby.
You're so welcome.
It's really lovely.
Barbara.
Thank you. It was just beautiful. And I don't really know you at all. I mean, just sitting. But to be privileged to hear what you've gone through and your journey is just amazing. And I really admire you. Obviously, it's not that easy, and the various steps you've taken, and I'm so glad that I'm part of this sangha. You are part of my life.
I'm glad you're part of mine, Barbara. Thank you. Yes, my dear.
I just wanted to say thank you. You are one of my teachers, too, and you just, something about the way you are in the world sometimes mirrors how I feel, and it's I can see myself better through you, and it's such an honor to know you.
Thank you.
Thank
you.
Really appreciate you.
Doug?
I'm so glad I came along today.
I'm so glad.
That was great. I'd say the same thing as Elizabeth. I think you are a great teacher. It's so wonderful to hear you talking, and you're so articulate and eloquent and deep. I'd love to see you teach more people, and whether it be Zen or whatever it is, you make people feel good when you talk. And we were talking about this morning, about Maya Angelou, that said, it's not, people won't necessarily remember what people say, they might not remember what you did, but they'll remember how you made them feel.
Mm-hmm.
And you make people feel great.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Abby, you were my practice period buddy, first, and you just helped me get engaged, what being a sangha was about and all the living here. And absolutely what Eldon said, you shared a lot of your soul, but I was so honest about it. And like you said, you've lived a long life and you've been through so much, at no point that you just kind of give up and I'm not doing this anymore and I'm just going to go hide anywhere. It's so brave of you. And you're still doing it.
Thank you. Thank you, Trina. Yeah. Terry?
For me, I was so touched with the sense of joy and openness that you didn't say the words, you kind of were the words as you moved through your life, being open and welcoming to whatever was coming towards you, whether it was getting divorced from your first husband, moving, coming back to Mill Valley, and you've come home. I loved being on the journey with you as you spoke, because I felt like I was with you. And thank you for including me in that way.
Oh, thank you, Jerry. Jerry, you have taught me so much about loving.
Anybody else? I have an enormous cramp in my right leg. That was beautiful, Abby, and what a great treat to have you as part of our Sangha. And of course, I look forward to many adventures, more with you. For someone who claims to not have many adventures in their life, I was surprised. Very cautious approach to living as we wandered around the globe, trying everything there was to try. So thank you.
Thank you so much.
Is this going to be a podcast?
I will put all Wayseeking Mind Talks on the website.